You're listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers, coming from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Meg Little Riley. She has worked for the White House Office of Management and Budget, at the U.S. Treasury, at the Environmental Defense Fund, and early in her career at Vermont Public Radio. She grew up in Brattleboro, Vermont, where her bio says she wrote terrible, heartfelt poetry in the woods. After an exciting detour in national politics, she's back at it in New England. When she's not writing, she's playing outside with her husband Dan and their two daughters. Here's a little information about her new book, We Are Unprepared, published by Mira Books. We Are Unprepared explores the human and social costs of living together on a changing earth. When an urbane 30-something couple moves to rural Vermont in search of a more authentic lifestyle, their plans are quickly upended by forecasts of a catastrophic superstorm threatening the East Coast. In this small town and struggling marriage, mounting fear drives everyone apart. People turn to vices, false religion, and rugged individualism for their survival. We Are Unprepared captures the precariousness of our sanity and the zeitgeist of these uncertain times. We may be unprepared, but there's hope on the other side. When I spoke with Meg Little Riley, I began by asking her to talk about her background and the extent to which her work in government might have informed her novel, We Are Unprepared.
When I began writing this, it wasn't quite as stark as it sounds in my bio. I'd been, it was something I'd always wanted to do. I studied writing years before in school, and I wasn't doing it with any discipline at all. And in my final years in the administration, when I was at the White House, I was suddenly struck by the fact that I had to just start doing it, even though it was an inconvenient time to do it. It always is, usually, I think, when one's writing a novel.
Right.
I did a lot of work writing in advance. I knew enough to know that I wasn't good at it yet, and I needed to just basically practice, read a lot about it. And then somewhere in that process, that was about a year's worth of work. And then the storyline for this book, We Are Unprepared, came together. And when it started to come together, it came together very quickly for me. Environmental issues are an important part of who I am. And although I was working as a spokesperson on primarily fiscal and budget and economic issues in the White House, which is something that I also followed and worked on closely as well in the administration. And part of it was just born out of a frustration for the slow pace of progress, policy-wise and politically. And there were two important moments for me when I really knew exactly what I wanted to write. And one of them happened in, I think it was 2010, when we had a storm called the Snowpocalypse at the time, in the mid-Atlantic. And it really was an extraordinary storm in Washington and Baltimore around there. We got like 3.5 feet of snow in just a couple of days. And everything kind of came to a grinding halt. It really, like, order unraveled quickly. And it's stark when you're in the nation's capital and you're working in government and tend to have some faith in the order that government can maintain. And civilization was just breaking down, it felt like. And government shut down, schools were shut down, some of them for weeks. People didn't have power in some cases for weeks. It was nuts. And I grew up in the country. I knew about, you know, big storms and power outages, but it was interesting to me I was thinking, wow, this is more, our sanity and our civility and order is a bit more precarious than I ever wanted to believe. And I knew I wanted to do something with that that was sort of the human piece of it. I was curious about how people behave in these moments of crisis and how our institutions respond as well. And then about a year, year and a half after that, Hurricane Irene struck the Northeast, and I was still in Washington, but I do have a memory of sitting at my desk and looking up at a screen at the White House, and it was live footage of CNN with coverage of Irene in my hometown of Brattleboro, Vermont, with just water racing through Main Street. And I remember just choking back tears and thinking, this is like science fiction. This isn't the kind of storm that's supposed to happen in this kind of place. And so it was born of sort of a bit of my anxiety about the changes that are afoot. So there are climate is a theme in the book, though I worked very hard to use restraint with my political opinions in it. No one wants to be lectured by their fiction.
Right.
So I don't really, I think I used the term maybe once in the whole book, but it is apparent that this is sort of what it's all about in it. So those were sort of, those were pieces of it. And I think to the jobs I'd had, so I'm sort of a political animal, which is part of why, my experience informs my opinions on the issue. But I also did a lot of writing, and as a communicator, that was something I had, a sort of a technical writing background in all of these ways. And I think the way I had to write professionally informs the kind of writing I do as a novelist as well.
Okay, that's really interesting. And so when you worked for the Environmental Defense Fund, did that work have anything to do with storms? Did you did that sort of inform your work through, you know, informing your research sort of secondhand, or not really?
Well, I certainly worked on climate issues, but the reason I went with the storm, aside from having having had those moments where it was kind of at the forefront of my mind, storms are also the problem of climate. It seems to suffer from a lack of proximity and urgency for us. Mm-hmm. We sort of all know how we should feel about it, what we should do, and yet there doesn't. It's abstract most of the time for us right now in the United States, except for superstorms. When we get big storms, which now all the climate community and the weather community are in agreement that, well, it's hard to draw one straight line from climate change to any one storm. We know that the frequency and intensity is related to climate. And so, but so storms are the moment when you really can't look away from climate change. And so if you're going to write a novel about climate change, unless it takes place over several hundred years, it's hard to kind of get something tangible to wrap your hands around.
Yeah.
Here, there are certainly parts of the country and the world where it's just closer to them. And there are other ways to write this story, but Vermont is what I know the best, and this was the most this was the most proximate way for me to consider climate there.
I thought it was interesting because I figured part of the reason that you set it in Vermont maybe had to do with the fact that you're from there and that you're familiar with it, but also with Irene and with changes in the storms and in the climate recently. The storms are getting up to Vermont, just like, you know, what you said. And I felt like that makes a statement in itself about how powerful a storm is for it to get all the way up to the Northeast Kingdom. Did that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, that was huge. I mean, if it was in Florida, it wouldn't have felt quite as historic in the story. I think that was a big part of the spookiness.
Right, yeah. Speaking of Florida, I remember the one big storm I've been through was Hurricane Charley. I was down visiting my mother in Sanibel, and there was one moment where I had taken my little boy and we had evacuated and we were at this motel and the eye of the hurricane passed over us and everybody in the motel came outside and stood and watched the sky change. And it was like this incredible moment of community. And while I was reading your book, I was really struck by the fact that these sorts of events are really frightening and they bring out the worst in people, but they also can bring out the best in people.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a story about a storm, but it's really more about who we are at our most fearful times and how we come together in moments of crisis. The central conflict in the story is whether we should take an individualistic approach or a more communal approach to surviving these crises. You know, whether your survival alone is enough if your neighbors aren't faring so well.
Right.
I think that is a big question of our day.
Yeah. Well, let's talk specifically about the book. Your main characters are Ash and Pia. From very early in the novel, it's apparent that although they feel very passionate about each other and the life that they envision sharing together, they have real contrasts. Pia is impulsive. She's emotional. Eventually in the book, she starts to seem really sort of unbalanced, but I don't want to get too far into it and give too much away. Ash is much more cautious. He's also maybe a little less proactive. So I wonder if you can talk about developing these characters and also keeping their relationship real by including both the bright and sort of increasingly dark sides of their interactions.
Yeah, when I initially conceived of the story, I sort of thought about it in three tiers. I was thinking about how fear can corrode our sanity and our relationships, and how things can unravel at the sort of most personal domestic level, and then also community, and then a broader social level. And I didn't really write that story because as I kept peeling back the layers of the onion on that fear, it just kept taking me to a more and more intimate place. So it really is a story about a relationship more than anything else. And I liked the idea that this was a couple that they really do have a great deal of passion for one another. And by the point that the novel starts, they have a common history and lots of good memories, but there had always been fractures, and there were fractures that were easily enough ignored in the sort of the busy noise of our daily lives. And there's a kind of clarity that comes with crisis, I suppose. For one thing, their lives weren't quite so busy or noisy once they moved to a remote and rural place, but also because there was a sort of there's the doom of the storm. A lot of that stuff falls away. I think it's one of the reasons I also like to read and watch catastrophe stories too, because I think it's interesting to consider like what your most essential self is when you don't have the luxury of all those daily comforts and routines. And so once those things fall away, they have to reckon with who they really are and what they really have in common. And she has a weaker grasp on sanity. And I was a little, it was strange to write the story from a male viewpoint about a woman who's a little nutty. I was very nervous about doing that, in fact.
I didn't even think about that.
It kind of went against my impulses, but there were reasons. The main reason, it's kind of a wimpy reason, but the main reason I wrote it from Ash's viewpoint was because I have some things in common with Ash, being from Vermont and sort of moving back to New England and stuff. And I just felt like if that character were the wife, I might accidentally either write myself into the character or write myself away from it. And I, with that psychic distance of gender, at least I felt like I had just a little space to let the character be who he was going to be. And the other thing about it that was nice was that I think fear defies, I think, sex and gender and sexuality. And I wanted to try to stay at that really core feeling of fear. I think men and women express them differently, but I don't think they feel fear differently necessarily. So it kind of held me accountable to that idea in a way. I couldn't rely on really gendered ideas about what it feels like to be in crisis.
Yeah. Now, I like to ask certain guests this question, and I think your novel is particularly good for this discussion. I like to talk a little bit about the value of conflict in fiction and what this brings to a narrative. And I wondered if you have any ideas about that.
Conflict is probably at the heart of most good stories. It's certainly at the heart of this one. And I thought about the conflict in this story as there's a sort of looming threat, there are few very precise moments where the storm is actually the conflict. It's not, the story really isn't about the storm. And so I had these sort of two tracks of, I'm going to call them tension for this. There's a sort of increasing tension of the storm, and then the conflict in the book is really where ideological lines start to be drawn among the people. So it's among the husband and wife in the story, but then also among other people in their community, and everybody starts to retreat into their respective corners and how they think they should be preparing and considering what their obligation is to one another. And so all of the moments at which the choices need to be made based on their worldviews, which now seem very starkly different under this more frightening veil, those are the conflict moments in it. That was how I kind of mapped it out in my head at the very start, and I think that's pretty much how it unfolded. I think tension and anxiety is the most dominant feeling in the book, even more than conflict, actually.
Right, yeah. You're listening to Write the Book and an interview with the author Meg Little Riley, whose new book is We Are Unprepared, published by Mira Books. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you'd go to iTunes, please, and rate it. Or just pass along the show's information to some friends. Thanks, and keep listening. And the other thing that's interesting to me was the fact that you also had a subject of infertility as part of the story. Mm-hmm. And the idea of this dangerous storm and the idea of wanting to have a family despite danger. And then also there's this interesting undercurrent of if we can't have a baby and yet there are children who need a home, and particularly in this dangerous time, you know, what can we bring to society or to our community? Anyway, so without giving too much away, I just wonder if we can talk about the subject of infertility and having mm-hmm. a family in a dangerous time.
Yeah, this was definitely something I drew from where I was at the time as I was writing the book as well, because my husband and I were starting to think about starting our own family. And I wrote most of this book while I was pregnant with my first. I have two daughters, they're 2 and 4. And we had trouble getting pregnant with our first. And when you have to consider how you're going to get pregnant, regardless of the paths you end up having to take, or there's this moment where you realize, like, oh, this isn't just going to happen. And all of a sudden, even though it was an intentional choice, it becomes really intentional after that, because you may have to take more proactive steps to make it happen. And then it's and we had a lot of really great discussions between us, my husband and I, about what it means and what is it. Why do we want this, and how do we want it to happen? And you have to kind of let go of some of your preconceived romantic ideas about how it's supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a combination of considering what the world would look like when we did start a family, and also considering what the more selfish elements of selfish and hopeful elements of having children. And as I was writing about this slightly dystopian, gloomy future, I mean, I think it's a hopeful book, but it kind of goes to a dark place. That was a question I had to ask myself too, was can we all do this? Are we supposed to be doing this? And I think having kids might still be a selfish act, but I also know that it's a very hopeful one. And I think the book makes clear that I'm an optimist about human nature, and, So I think that it's hard to imagine. One needn't have children, bear children, or raise them to have this feeling. But I think that the idea of making the future better and investing in climate solutions and things like that, it also you have to consider what the experience of children in the future will be. You don't have to be a mother to feel that feeling. But I think that the theme of kids and fertility and future generations, it felt so natural with the questions that are grappled with in the story.
Absolutely. I thought it was really interesting. Now, I didn't mention this before when we were talking about their characters, but Ash and Pia have moved to Vermont in order to live differently than they used to live in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And so there's a line in the book, I'm not looking at it, but it's there's something along the lines of that they were just part of a movement of others in their generation who are making the same choice. Do you think this is a movement with people of the generation that you're describing, which is, what were they, their late 20s?
Yeah, they're in their like early 30s. Yeah.
Early 30s, okay. So do you think that there's a movement of that sort?
I don't think it's universal, but I do think that there is, and this isn't the first generation to do this. We've seen previous ones as well, where there's a sort of small counterculture group of people who are rejecting a more traditional materialism, and so I think in that sense, I mean, I know some of these people, and I grew up in Brattleboro, Vermont, which is a place that was kind of in many ways colonized by the first wave of a lot of anti-war activists and things like that.
Hippies.
Yeah. So I think that there is this not insignificant portion of, I guess, probably the millennials would be the generation now who are doing this. But I also think more broadly, you don't have to move away to feel what this couple is feeling, which is that it's a different, in the wake of an economic recession and a burst housing bubble. And I think a lot of people in their 20s and 30s don't have all of the same economic choices that were available to them. And I'm talking about compared to people who were born like 10 years earlier, perhaps. And so there's a sort of reevaluation of what success looks like. I mean, it's not everybody's doing it, but I think there's an interesting thing going on there. I make a little fun of this couple as well, because they have a sort of vague notion of living a more authentic life.
Right.
And they're sure that this is the medicine that they need for what ails them. And they are indeed unprepared, and often and also they're a little wrong about it. You don't have to move to the most remote corner of the continent to find peace, whatever that is. So some of it is also just a kind of there's a sort of superficial and romantic notion of how to cure what ails them in the story. I think it's well intentioned, but I do sort of see it's a very, I think it's particularly in urban, liberal, coastal places, I think it's familiar.
Sure. Yeah, at one point, and I think this is relevant, at one point Pia says that she's too selfish to do anything truly good, but choosing to live a life that doesn't make the world worse is a good thing to do also. And I just, I laughed out loud when I read that. I was like, wow.
It's a little bratty.
Well, I guess it's true. I mean, there are a lot of people that don't give a second thought to the way they live their lives and what they leave behind and what they do to make the world better. So, in fact, she's not making a true statement there, but it's just funny because up until that point, the book all feels so much about like they are moving forward with this very well-intentioned change in their life. And that was a funny line.
And the idea there is that it's sort of conveniently it requires no sacrifices from them at all.
At least they think so.
Right.
Now, you created a fictional town, and I believe in the book it's called Isole, although it originally comes from Isole from the French, which was great. It was like Montpelier and how it's pronounced in Vermont. So, although it's not supposed to be Montpelier, it's a little town up in the Northeast Kingdom. So I wonder if you can talk about the experience of inventing a town.
Yeah, so I know the Northeast Kingdom quite well. I've gone up there in summers for a very long time, and so it's kind of a composite of, for anybody who knows the Northeast Kingdom, it's sort of a composite of Barton and Glover and parts of St. Johnsbury, and I was picturing a completely fictional downtown. And that I drew a little picture for myself, so I knew where the shops were. And it's very small; it's like two blocks long. And there are certainly some of the characters in this town are kind of Yankee archetypes. I tried not to make them Yankee stereotypes, but I tried to make them more complex than that. But there is a sort of familiar, I think, philosophy of people I've known who've lived in places that have harsh winters, and they're super self-reliant and smart and more sophisticated than the rest of the world recognizes. And
right.
So that was sort of what, I definitely drew on some archetypes that I knew of. The physical town was mostly an invention, but really it's kind of a little mashup of all the towns I knew.
Okay, great. I enjoyed reading about it. Living in Vermont, I enjoyed reading about it. Talk about the movement of time in We Are Unprepared. There's a certain amount of backstory, and then there's a kind of real time, and then there's the implication of a before and an after. So I wondered how you came to your chronological structure.
Yeah. I knew that I wanted the story to start at basically the moment at which we knew changes were afoot, because it frankly seemed like the only way to capture people, to capture the reader. So I do spend in several sections in the first like half of the book. We also go back to Ash and Pia's relationship back in Brooklyn, because things are already starting to fray at the start of this story, and I needed to go back to establish the fact that these people really had something once that made it all worthwhile. There's a reason they're together, and there's a reason that what they could lose feels so consequential. So that was the reason I wanted to keep skipping back. And then it's aside from that, it's a pretty chronological story. So the forecast at the start of the story is such that we know terrible storms are coming, mm-hmm. but because we don't really ever know when a bad storm is coming until like we're like a week out from it in real life. Basically, the forecast keeps getting more precise, and there's a feeling as you move through the story that there's one more weather event ahead, and then maybe they sort of go through it. And with each one, they wonder, I hope this is the worst. Is this the worst it's going to get? If this is the worst, I think I can handle it. We can probably survive it. But because there's that unknown of weather, there's no clear catastrophe countdown in the story. And it's that not knowing that I think creates a lot of the anxiety about it. So in that sense, I keep just sort of like pulling the time along with this sort of a fresh wave of dread.
Yeah.
That was sort of how I thought about it. It was important that they not know when or what this happens. It's not even the events themselves. It's the fear of what could be.
Yeah.
That freaks everyone out.
Absolutely. Okay. let's see. You have a group in the book called the Preppers, mm-hmm. which I think comes from preparation for getting ready for this big storm. I can't remember actually, but I think that's what it was. And they're a fairly paranoid group of folks. In addition to being fearful, so their paranoia is driven by very real fear. And I wondered if you had any kind of groups in mind when you created this group of activists, I guess they are.
Oh, and, yeah.
Yeah.
Preppers are real.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, preppers, it's not a term people use in New England much, and so most people don't know that when we talk about it, but I actually, the idea for this came a couple years ago, or right around the time, I guess, before I started writing the book. I remember reading a New York Times article about preppers, and that's the term that they used, and it always stuck with me because I thought, this is an interesting, if it is a trend, and there were no numbers, but if it is a trend, this is a very, very interesting one, and so I did a lot of internet research about them. So preppers are sort of a self-identified group of catastrophe preparedness enthusiasts, and they call themselves preppers, and they exist mostly on the internet, though there are real-life meetings of preppers. I saw some in like Michigan and the Southwest. The interesting thing about preppers, so there's sort of a range. It starts with folks who just want to be more self-reliant. Maybe they want to take their house off the grid and go solar. Some people want to get they want to go off the grid financially, so they're not using credit cards, making any electronic records of their transactions. And it's interesting because they're organized by an idea of being prepared for something, but what they're preparing for really varies. So some people are preparing for a weather catastrophe. Other people are preparing for race riots and the government to come for them. And there's like, At its most accessible and logical, it's just people, you know, keeping water bottles in their basement. And then there is a wildly paranoid other end to it. And it's an interesting and kind of spooky dark rabbit hole in the internet to go down. But it was really interesting for me because there are parts of it that are really appealing, right? Like to know how to do more things for yourself. Especially as someone who grew up in the country, I love that. I would like to, you know. So, a lot of it feels just smart, and then you make one more right click, and you find something terrifying. And the other question I think it asks of us is, how do you prepare for the unknown while still living fully in the present? You know, I wonder if you invest too much time and resources in preparing for what your catastrophe scenario, don't you start to almost wish it comes just to make all that worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I wanted to ask you about your publishing experience. You are published with Mira Books.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go about finding your publisher?
So I did all of this the traditional way. I wrote the book. Actually, I got an agent after with some earlier writing, and I just sent query letters and sent my work, and I got an agent at Trident Media in New York, and that took several months, it took like 6 months, I think, something like that. I sort of sent out a couple different waves of things and tried to improve my work along the way, and then I wrote the whole book, and then he started shopping for publishers, and that took another, everything is so slow, you know, because you want to do the slow tiers to give everybody time to work it through their system until they finally give you a no. And so that was something like, I think, another year. And then the book that is out there now is almost identical to the book that we sent to them. There were very little edits once we actually found a publisher that was interested. It was, it's excruciating, and it takes forever, and it comes with so many no's along the way, looking for agents, looking for publishers. And I still think I had a relatively easy process, but it's easy to say that now. Politics is a pretty high contact sport, but I've just never had a harder and more like affecting set of challenges than this, because it mattered so much to me, and it's so heartbreaking with every no, and they just sort of come at you randomly when you're not expecting it to pop up in your email inbox. And I now think it was so good and worthwhile, and I'm so glad that I stuck it out. Not that I was ever considering not sticking it out, but it's like eventually when you realize it doesn't kill you, you're invincible after that, you know? It's easier to have a little more perspective on it now, but it's hard and long, and I'm still grateful for it.
Great. Okay. So I wanted to ask what you're working on now. Are you writing a new book, or you've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, so maybe you just don't have time?
No, I am writing another book. It is harder to write a book with a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old than it was to write it while I worked at the White House, that is for sure. Yes, I've done a lot of writing since then, and I'm working on a novel now that it actually takes place on Martha's Vineyard. More of a straightforward psychological thriller, and it's going to be another book with a real sense of place. The location and the environment is a character in the same way that it was, I think, in my last book. But the similarities pretty much end there. There won't be a real direct climate element to it, except that the natural world is sort of what I write about inevitably, and so it's in there.
Okay, great. And then I also wanted to just ask if you have read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners.
Yes, oh my goodness. Well, I haven't even finished it. I started it 2 days ago, and I can't put it down. I'm reading Ann Patchett's Commonwealth right now.
Oh, yeah, right.
Which is great. This year has been, I feel like, so many great books this year. Book that really stuck with me, I read a couple months ago, I keep recommending, is it's from last year. His name is Christopher Scotton. It's a debut, The Secret Wisdom of the Earth.
Oh.
It's about coal country in West Virginia, and it's just a beautiful novel about a completely different rural place in a different time, and it's sort of a coming-of-age story. I loved it so much.
Great.
A fast, fun thriller that I read recently was Noah Hawley's After the Fall, Before the Fall, Before the Fall.
Oh, right, yeah, with the airplane?
With the airplane, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was about, and I bought it in an airport kiosk before I got on the airplane. Not recommended. But it's just a smart page turner, which is a hard thing to accomplish, I think, so I appreciated that, too.
Wonderful. The title of the book is We Are Unprepared. It's a novel by Meg Little Riley, published by Mira Books. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Meg. I really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
That again was a conversation with Meg Little Riley. You can learn more about her work at meglittleriley.com, and her last name is spelled R-E-I-L-L-Y. This week's Write the Book prompt concerns the word storm, which has many uses, perhaps because the impact that storms have always had on the populations that experience them. Here are a few brief definitions and synonyms. A storm is a violent disturbance of the atmosphere with strong winds and usually rain, thunder, lightning, or snow. Windstorm, tempest, whirlwind, gale, squall. A tumultuous reaction, an uproar or controversy. As a verb, the word storm can mean to move angrily or forcefully in a specified direction. To storm off, stomp, march, stalk, flounce, stamp. It can be a sudden attack and capture by means of force. Someone stormed the Capitol yesterday. This week, write a story, poem, or essay in which any form of the word storm or one of its synonyms has significance. If, for example, you have a friend who spells her name Gale, G-A-L-E, as I do, and yes, her parents were right to spell it that way, then you can go ahead and write about her. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book on Facebook for updates. That's changed. It used to say Write the Book Radio Show, but now that we're only podcasting until the new radio station is ready for us to start broadcasting, it's just Write the Book on Facebook. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I said earlier, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, write a review, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.